on the day of our priestly ordination, we're all instructed to model our lives in the mystery of the Lord's cross. We priests are called to do that in many ways, but some of us seem to be given a greater share in those crosses on earth. Learning how to bear them is a secret to fidelity and spiritual fruitfulness. A great model for all priests in this is Father Walter Szyszek, the first American Byzantine Rite Jesuit priest. Soon after he entered the Soviet Union under assumed name in 1940 to do missionary work, he was captured and accused of being a spy. He spent 5 years in the notorious Lubyanka prison in Moscow, where he was repeatedly tortured before being sent to Siberia for a sentence of 15 years of hard labor in response to a drugged and tortured confession that he was a spy. He's released in 1963 in a prisoner exchange. Many of us have read about his story in the two books, With God in Russia and He Leadeth Me. Over the last 21 years of his life, until he died on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, 1984, he continued his priestly work at the John XXIII Center at Fordham, preaching retreats, giving talks, and helping others through spiritual direction and counseling. To speak to us of what all priests can learn from Father Szyszek's priestly life and example, there's no one more qualified than Monsignor Anthony Muntone, priest of the Diocese of Allentown, who, together with Jesuit Father Thomas Sable of the Passaic Eparchy, is co-postulator of Father Szyszek's cause. He prepared all of the documentation on Father Szyszek's heroic theological and cardinal virtues, submitted to the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints in Rome. Monsignor Muntone is a graduate of the North American College and pastor emeritus of St. Elizabeth of Hungary Parish in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. Please join me in welcoming him. He leadeth us into the heroic priestly life of Father Szyszek. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Father Roger, for the warm welcome, for the very warm invitation to come here to this beautiful place to talk a little bit about Father Szyszek. It's always a great pleasure. I know that you may be wondering a little bit about the observation that Father Roger made, that Bishop Coleman and Bishop Edivine and I are classmates. They look so much older than I. The fact is, I'm considerably older than they. I've been retired for 2 years now from a wonderful parish. And in the course of my retirement, I've learned something about the life of a priest, the lifespan of a priest, the stages in a priest's life. There is that wonderful stage called youth that I see some of you are in the middle of right now. Hold on to it. Inevitably, we pass from that to that stage called middle age. And it's an age that we're grateful to go into and sometimes grateful to pass out of. But I am now at that third stage of a priest's life, that stage that is frequently referred to as, you look pretty good.
Pretty good, James.
It has been my very great privilege to serve as the co-postulator for Father Walter's cause since 1996. The cause actually had been started by the Ruthenian Catholic Diocese of Passaic. The bishop there, Bishop Dudek, was very, very devoted to Father Walter, a very good friend of his personally, and at the time of Father Walter's death, immediately began to collect the documents pertaining to Father's life, and he got permission from the Holy See and opened the cause. However, as happens inevitably, time passed, and the bishop came to the point where he had to submit his resignation, he had to retire as Bishop of Passaic, and the new bishop who succeeded him wasn't particularly interested in pursuing the cause any further, and he very happily approached my bishop, Bishop Thomas Welch of the Diocese of Allentown. The dioceses covered the same territory. Actually, Passaic was much larger, but the Diocese of Passaic included also the territory included in the Diocese of Allentown. And in the Diocese of Allentown is Father Chiswick's hometown and home parish of Shenandoah. So Bishop Welch, who was very devoted to Father Chiswick, was very happy and enthusiastic about the opportunity to accept responsibility for the cause. And then the bishop, when accepted, after accepting responsibility for the cause, did what bishops usually do. He found someone else to do the work for him and asked me to be a postulator. And however, I must say it was one of the greatest graces and blessings that has ever come into my life. Although I am from the same hometown as Father Walter, I never met him. Never got to know him personally. However, working as I have over these years, since 1996 on the cause, reading so many of the wonderful things he had written, his homilies, his spiritual journals, his retreat notes, I feel that I know him intimately. And he truly is an inspiring priest and a wonderful model of priestly holiness. And I consider it a real privilege to come here today and share with you a little bit about his life. And I'm truly, truly grateful, Father Roger, for your having invited me. Father Chiswick was born in Shenandoah, a small mining town in Pennsylvania, in 1904. And he was the son of Polish immigrants, Mary and Martin Chiswick. Father's father was a coal miner, and his mother was a very pious Third Order Franciscan, who was the mother of 13 children. They were very good Catholics, we'd have to say. It would seem that as Walter was growing up, however, that the deep faith and piety of his parents made very little impression on him. He was a very tough kid, and that was the description that he himself used in describing himself as a child, as a young child growing up. He was always in fights, always in difficulty, and sometimes very serious difficulty. And his father was a very good man, very stern man, as fathers were in those days, you could imagine, 13 kids. But he really had a very hard time disciplining Walter, bringing him around. And it's recorded, Walter himself records it, that his father actually brought him to one of the local magistrates and asked if Walter could be sent away to a reform school for a while because he was so incorrigible that he couldn't do anything with him. And fortunately, the magistrate convinced him that he should try a little harder, be patient with him, and eventually he might turn around. And the fact is that eventually he did. But that toughness that was at the core of Walter's personality and character, it never left him. And he feels, as hopefully we'll explain in the course of this talk, that it was a gift, it was a grace, it was something given to him by Providence so that he might deal with all the difficult things with which he would have to deal in his life. Walter shocked his parents and especially his father when he graduated from eighth grade at the local Catholic school. He announced that he wanted to study for the priesthood. And his father was strenuously opposed, absolutely not. And he had explained to Walter that he loved the church far too much to let Walter become a However, this was the beginning of a trait that surfaces constantly throughout Walter's life. Whenever he's opposed, he digs in and will never take no for an answer. And he just insisted and insisted. And eventually, he went off to study for the priesthood at a seminary in Orchard Lake, Michigan. It was a seminary that had been established to educate Polish American boys for the Catholic priesthood. And while Walter was there at Orchard Lake, a Jesuit had been invited to come and preach the annual retreat to the seminarians. Naturally, the Jesuit coming to preach to Polish American young men preached to them about a Polish Jesuit, Saint Stanislaus Kostka. Walter was deeply inspired by the preaching on Saint Stanislaus. So deeply inspired, he decided then and there he had to be a Jesuit. There was a problem. His father, who was just beginning to get accustomed to the fact that Walter was studying for the diocesan priesthood, had now to hear from Walter that he wanted to become a Jesuit. His father wasn't really sure what a Jesuit was, and he was determined that Walter would stay the course and become a diocesan priest. And Walter and his father had another knockdown, drag-out fight. His father never really agreed, but Walter went off to Fordham to meet the Jesuit provincial at the time and to tell him that he wanted to become a Jesuit. There was a problem with that. The Jesuits weren't really convinced that they wanted Walter. However, that did not deter Walter. He found his way into the provincial's office and announced he was there to see the provincial because he wanted to become a Jesuit. And some nice person in the office said, what they usually say on occasions like that, "I'm sorry, but the provincial isn't in today." Walter said, "Fine, I'll stay and wait till he comes." And he camped out literally all that day in the provincial's office. Provincial was in his office, Walter. And the only way he could get home was to go through the waiting room where Walter was waiting for him. And Walter, with a great deal of enthusiasm, if not vehemence, explained that he had to become a Jesuit. The provincial eventually agreed, probably because he realized it was the only way he would get home that night, to accept Walter into the province. And Walter entered the Jesuit novitiate, which at that time was also in the Diocese of Allentown in a town called Wernersville near Reading in Pennsylvania. While Walter was at the novitiate, the novice master received a letter, the superiors received a letter from Pope Pius XI. And the Pope, the Holy Father, was asking Jesuit seminarians to consider volunteering to go to Rome to study at what was then a new institute just opened called the Rusicum. It was a seminary in Rome at which seminarians would be trained in the Eastern Rites to enter Russia clandestinely, where the persecution of church had really begun in earnest. And that these priests who were ordained for that mission, a very dangerous work, would go there and exercise their ministry and minister to the persecuted Catholics and even Orthodox in Russia. Walter, when he heard the invitation, quite naturally, immediately volunteered. Problem? His Jesuit superiors felt Walter was not the kind of a person, not cut out for this kind of work. Walter disagreed. Once again, there was a long discussion until the Jesuit superiors came to realize opposition was futile. And Walter finally succeeded in convincing them that he should be admitted into the program. Walter went to Rome, went to the Rusicum, studied for the priesthood, and finally was ordained a priest on June 24th, 1937, in Rome. In November of the following year, he was assigned to a Jesuit mission in a town called Albertine, which was away off in easternmost Poland, practically on the Russian border. Walter was very disappointed and told his superiors he had studied to go into Russia, and here he was in Poland. They tried to explain to him there was a reason for that. the persecution in Russia at that time was really fierce, and it was very, very dangerous for a priest to go into Russia. Walter didn't agree, but in obedience had to accept it, and he remained for a while there in Albertine, and then all of a sudden, God made other arrangements. In 1939, the Germans and the Russians signed a treaty, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Agreement, in which the Germans and the Russians thought it would be a nice idea to divide Poland in two. The Germans would take the western half, the Russians would take the eastern half, and it worked out perfectly for Walter because he was in easternmost Poland. And so the Russians made it possible for Walter to realize his dream. He was in Russia. However, it was a very, very difficult time. The Russian soldiers had came into the mission where Walter had been assigned. They had been barbarous in their treatment of everyone, a little bit like what's happening in the Ukraine these days. And Walter went underground. That is, he volunteered to, he responded to a call for volunteer laborers who would work in lumber camps in the Ural Mountains in southern Russia. So Walter accepted that, and he did go into Russia disguised as a laborer to work in the lumber camps, and it was his hope that he could work secretly as a priest. Many of the laborers were Catholics. They were Poles who had been invited, maybe more than invited, forcibly brought into Russia to work in those camps. And he hoped that there would be opportunities to minister to them, but to his disappointment, the opportunities were very limited. They were very, very closely watched. It was very, very difficult and dangerous, so Walter was not able to do very much. However, he continued for almost a year in those camps in the Urals. Then finally, in 1941, the following year, things changed drastically. The Germans betrayed the Russians and invaded Russia. Almost immediately, at the time of the German invasion of Russia, Walter was arrested. It appears that the secret police, knew all along that he was a priest. They had been watching him carefully. But at the time of the invasion by the Germans, they thought it was opportune to arrest him and necessary to arrest him. And he was sent off to Moscow, as Father Roger said, to Lubyanka, a terrible place, a prison run by the secret police in Moscow. And it was a very, very difficult time for Walter. His resistance to the communist interrogators, as you might imagine, knowing a little bit of his personality, his resistance was firm. It was determined. But he was beaten. He was drugged. He was threatened. He was in solitary confinement. And he was convinced he could handle all of that. And little by little, they did break him. And he signed a confession, a preposterous confession, a confession that he was a Vatican spy. He was sentenced to 15 years at hard labor. After he had signed the confession, he went back into solitary confinement. And left to himself, he describes it as the lowest point in his life. He was convinced that he could beat these Russians, he would say, with one hand tied behind his back. But he didn't beat them, they beat him. First time in his life. It was a long and painful period of deep disappointment in himself. He began slowly to put his life back together, and he came to see that his failure was one of the greatest graces that he had ever received. It was his kenosis. It was the occasion of his complete emptying of self. It was the difficult letting go of his exaggerated conviction that he could handle anything because he was tough. Tougher than anyone who dared to oppose him. Gradually, he had come to realize he failed because he was not relying on God. He was relying totally on himself. His thoughts in that difficult time turned to the Lord's agony in the Garden of Gethsemane, where in spite of his clear perception of the horrors of the passion which awaited him, Jesus nonetheless accepted it all fully, saying, "Father, not my will, but your will be done." And it was right there that Walter received the grace-filled insight that would change his life. Jesus accepted the Father's will for him. But he did not accept the Father's will for him as some sort of vague abstraction somewhere out in the mysterious cloud of unknowing. He accepted the Father's will for him in the concrete circumstances of his life. He accepted the Father's will in the betrayal by Judas, and the denial by Peter, and the abandonment by the others, and the false accusations, and the judgment of the Sanhedrin. He accepted the Father's will in the cowardly cynicism of Pilate, the flogging, the carrying of the cross, and finally, his horrible death upon it. Jesus accepted the Father's will in the concrete circumstances of his life, it became clear to Walter. Walter gradually came to realize that he could do no less than Jesus did. That he was being called to accept God's will for him in the concrete circumstances of his life, in the solitary confinement in Lubyanka. The endless interrogations, the beatings, the daily threats of death, and all the horrors that had come into his life, as well as those horrors which still awaited him in an unseen and very uncertain future. Little by little, he did begin, by God's grace, to put his life back together again. But it was now a life completely different from the life he had lived up to that point. He had undergone a complete conversion. Afterwards, whenever he spoke of that conversion, he would say, "I went to Russia to show God the great things I would do for him in Russia. But in Russia, God showed me the great things he would do for me." And the greatest thing that God did for Walter in Russia was to teach him the true meaning of Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane, "Father, not my will, but your will be done." He remained in Lubyanka for the remainder of the duration of the Second World War, 6 more years, all of it in solitary confinement. During those years in solitary confinement, he faithfully followed every day the routine that he had followed during his years as a novice at Warnersville. He made his meditation first thing in the morning, prayed the rosary on his knuckles. He would mentally celebrate the Eastern Rite liturgy, which he had committed to memory as part of his training in Rome. And he did that day after day for 4 or 5 more years. With the end of the Second World War, he was sent from Lubyanka to the slave labor camps of Siberia for the remainder of his sentence, 9 years at hard labor. Once again, he suffered untold hardships. In Siberia, the cold was unbelievable. The hunger was constant. Their daily ration of food was a crust of bread the size of a fist, 2 lumps of sugar, and a cup of hot water. The work was backbreaking and very dangerous in mines and in mills and in the construction of the cities of Siberia. And on top of all that, he lived under the constant threat of death. The life of the prisoners was held to be of very little regard, were killed for little or no reason. But it was in the labor camps that he at last found the opportunity to do the work for which he had been sent to Russia. In the labor camps, he secretly celebrated Holy Mass. He would hold on to that little bit of bread that he received as his daily ration. Prisoners who had already been released and were living in the area would manage somehow, through God's providence and grace, were able to smuggle in a little bit of grape juice. With that little bit of grape juice and that crust of bread, he would celebrate Mass. And when he celebrated Mass, they would fast the whole day through that work day, not even eating the crust of bread that was theirs, so that when they returned from work that evening, they could celebrate Mass together. Such was their devotion to the Eucharist and the great graces and strength that came to them from that clandestine, very dangerous celebration of the Eucharist. He heard confessions sitting alongside someone on those planks that they used for bread, for beds. He consoled prisoners, encouraged them. He even organized and gave retreats. All of this he did at the peril of his life. He was finally released from the slave labor camps after 9 years of that. But when he was released, he was still not free. He was released to what the Russians called internal exile. He was confined to certain cities in Siberia, where he was under constant surveillance by the secret police. He was first sent to the Siberian city of Norilsk, away up there near the Arctic Circle. He had to find a job to support himself. Got a job as an automobile mechanic. But little by little, he began to minister as priest. The Russians, in some strange twist of God's providence, had deported to Siberia millions of Catholics, Poles and Lithuanians mostly. They were in these cities of Siberia. Little by little, they found Walter. Little by little, Walter began to celebrate Mass again, hear confessions, minister to these people. At first it was a trickle of people, and the crowds grew larger and larger until inevitably it attracted the attention of the secret police, who descended upon him and said he was not allowed to do that. Walter stood right up to them and quoted to them the provisions of the Soviet Constitution, which guaranteed freedom of religion. The secret police responded by packing him up and bringing him off to another Siberian town, where Walter did the same thing all over again. He began little by little to attract the Catholics, celebrate the sacraments, attract the attention of the secret police. Off he went to another town. It happened 3 times. But the efforts of the secret police to stop Walter were all in vain. That stubborn, determined Polish kid from Shenandoah was very much alive in Walter, and he enjoyed it tremendously. And the police and the people dealing with him just couldn't figure him out anymore. He was not troubled anymore. He was filled with an incredible spirit of peace. He just smiled back at them. Nothing they did could frighten him. The fear that they were able to instill in people was one of the strongest weapons that they would use in getting their way. But it was a weapon that simply didn't work with Walter. Eventually, his communist captors grew tired of dealing with Walter and his unshakable faith in God. He simply would not be intimidated by their threats. They had run out of Siberian cities to which they might send them. So finally, 23 years later, in 1963, he was miraculously, and I believe it was miraculous, returned to the United States. in exchange for a Russian spy who had been apprehended in Washington. His Jesuit confreres were absolutely shocked. They had already received a notice some years before reminding them of their obligation to celebrate Mass for their dead confrere. All of those Masses had been celebrated. I don't know how the Jesuit moral theologians handled that one. But when Walter arrived home, it was on Columbus Day, 1963, October 12th. He came to what was then Idlewild Airport in New York, now JFK, and we were expecting to find this emaciated shell of a man who was presumed dead and had been 23 years in communist prisons. Instead, when Walter finally stepped off the plane and to the Jesuits and some members of his family who were waiting for him, they were shocked by what they saw. He was very robust in spite of the hardships. Not simply were they pleasantly surprised by his excellent physical condition, everyone was very much taken aback by the spirit of peace that seemed to emanate from him. Everyone who saw him had the same reaction. Everyone would say it was his eyes. And indeed, even in the pictures of Walter, even if you see them, there is something very special about those eyes. You know, they're attached to the back of his head somehow, as happens with truly spiritual people. And they began little by little to understand why it was Walter was filled with that spirit of peace, that something very special had happened to him in Russia. When he returned home, he wasn't content to go off to some nice Jesuit retreat house. I'm told there are a few of those. Instead, he was convinced God had sent him back home to the United States for a reason. And he was convinced the reason was so that he might share with us the spiritual insights which he had learned in Russia. It was his pearl of great price. He purchased it in the prisons and slave labor camps of Russia. His provincial ordered him to write a book about his experiences. Walter wasn't really interested in writing about himself, but he did. He wrote With God in Russia, the first of his two books. And he detailed his experiences in Russia. But there was a book he wanted to write. And pretty soon, a few years later, he did, his second book entitled He Leadeth Me, taking its theme from the 23rd Psalm. And in the second book, he wrote about the spirituality which sustained him in Russia. Gradually, Walter was discovered by people who realized he's very special. People would go to him for spiritual direction. He became a spiritual director to hundreds, eventually thousands of people. And he shared with them a simple and profound spirituality, which had come to fill his own very difficult life with so much peace. He labored tirelessly to bring a share in that peace to all who would come to him. They came in ever greater numbers. He was unstintingly available to anyone who came to him. Even as the ravages of age and his earlier hardships began to take a severe toll on his health and stamina, he would always answer the bell. He lived in the Jesuit faculty house at Fordham, and many people would come and ring that bell. And you might be surprised to know that in spite of the fact there might have been 20, 30 priests in the house, there were not too many rushing down to answer the doorbell. Walter always went down to answer the bell, even though later in his life he almost literally had to drag himself down. And he would say simply, God sent that person to ring the doorbell. And who are we not to go and answer it? He was very faithful to this ministry of spiritual direction. He was, in spite of all that he was suffering physically, and finally he died peacefully, but totally exhausted by his long years of suffering and ministering to others. He died while praying his breviary on Our Lady's feast day, December 8th, 1984, at the age of 80. The spirituality which Father Walter shared with all those who came to him was very simple and very uncomplicated. As simple and uncomplicated as he was, Jesuit though he was not an intellectual. He failed his exam at the Gregorian University. He was never awarded a degree in theology. That should make him very popular with a lot of seminarians. Deep down, he always remained spiritually the son of those very devout Polish immigrants. In a very real sense, it was their faith that he rediscovered in Russia. It was a faith based on the conviction that God was really and truly working in his life. Subtly, quietly, patiently, lovingly, leading him from one experience, which was really the preparation for the next one. It became increasingly clear to him as he meditated on his past life. Nothing in his life had happened by accident. If he had not gone to Orchard Lake, he would not have heard that retreat master speak of St. Stanislaus Kanska, and he would not have entered the Jesuits. If he had not entered the Jesuits, he would not have known of the invitation of the Holy Father to study at the Russicum and prepare for Russia. If he had not attempted to minister in the lumber camps of the Urals, he would not have been arrested by the secret police. If he had not been arrested by the secret police, his mistaken conviction that he was totally sufficient would not have been taken away in Lubyanka. If his pride and sense of self-sufficiency had not been taken away in Lubyanka, he would never have discovered the great things that God planned to do for him in Russia. As God opened for him the opportunity to minister in the slave labor camps in Siberia. And finally, it was his ministry in Siberia which caused his communist captors to tire of him and led to his return to the United States, where he would share with us all that he learned about the ways of God in Russia. The closing of that circle made it clear to Father Chizik it was not only in the acceptance of God's will that he found the strength to face the trials and sorrows of life and still find peace. That was the spirituality he tried so mightily to share with everyone who came to him in the 21 years which remained after his return. He never bragged about how heroic he was in his sufferings, but he didn't hesitate to use the paradigm of his own life and helping others to see how God was working in their lives. He would sum it up over and over again by saying simply, surrender to God, and he will do everything for you. Does that sound familiar? It should. You've read it many, many times before. It's the antiphon to the first psalm of week 2 of the Office of Readings. Surrender to God, and he will do everything for you. Yet Father Walter would be the first to admit, while it's very easy to say we should just accept God's will, doing it remains a very difficult challenge. He certainly did not see it as a latter-day call to quietism. You know, oh, such terrible things are happening to me. We heard this before. There's nothing I can do about it. It's awful. Bad things happen to me. I might as well just accept it, lie down and die, endure it, let everyone know how unhappy I am about all the bad things happening. That was not Walter's spirituality. His was a very active acceptance of God's will. calculated to bring out of the hardship he was experiencing the good that God wanted him to accomplish, the good that God hid in that hardship. He didn't just endure 6 years of solitary confinement in Lubyanka. He made of the 6 years of solitary confinement a six-year-long spiritual renewal of his novitiate, an opportunity to draw closer to God every day of 6 years in prayer, closer than he had ever been. He didn't sullenly endure the sufferings of the labor camps. He gave it all he had. When he worked in those labor camps, in the mines, in the building of the cities in Siberia, he did the best possible job he could do. Often he would earn the anger of his fellow prisoners, who would do their very best to sabotage the work, to work slowly, to not do a good job, and they would question him about why was he working so hard to do such a good job. And he would just look at them and say, "Don't you understand? We're not building this city for Stalin. We're building it for God. God wants it built. And how could we not do the best possible job that we could do? If that's not holiness, I don't know what is." That was his idea of doing God's will. The acceptance of God's will in the concrete circumstances of his life. And a story told by one of his retreatants after his return from Russia, it's really very moving. I found this little nugget. He had asked this retreatant to pray St. Ignatius' prayer of surrender, the Sushipe. You may be familiar with it. The prayer reads, "Take, Lord, and receive all my liberty, my memory, my understanding, and my entire will. All I have and call my own. You have given all to me. To you, Lord, I return it. Everything is yours. Do with it what you will. Give me only your love and your grace. That is enough for me." That's the prayer. Father asked her to pray it. She turned to him and said, "Pray it together with me, Father." And he said to her, he would find it very difficult to pray that prayer with her. He had said the prayer many, many times in the novitiate at Wernersville. But he found it very hard to say that prayer in Russia. Because in Russia, it seemed to him, God had taken him very seriously when he said that. And he said it was very difficult for him to say it again, and he hadn't prayed it since he was arrested in Russia. But as I thought about that little story that I came upon in the documents we assembled, Walter never stopped praying the Sushipe. He prayed it over and over again. Perhaps not always in the same soaring words of St. Ignatius. He prayed it instead in the resignation with which he bore his sufferings in Lubyanka. He prayed it in the courage he showed in ministering to his flock in the prison camps. Most especially did he pray it in his selfless ministry to all who came to him after his return from Russia. To each and every one, he would say simply, not only in words, but by the inspiring example of the life he lived. He would say what he said to everyone who came searching for a share in that precious peace which overflowed from his life. Surrender to God and he'll do everything for you. That's exactly how Father Walter lived out his life. He followed in a most heroic way the example Jesus had set for him and the living his life. He surrendered completely to God, and God did indeed do everything for him. It is for all those reasons and so much more that those of us who have come to know something of Father Walter's life are convinced he is a saint, an inspiring example to every Christian, but most of all to us priests, because at times we struggle. we struggle to find God's will for us. And we struggle simply because we fail to see God's will for us where it really is. Where Walter shows it is. In the concrete circumstances of our daily lives. Thank you.
Some time for questions.
Now, Father, was his father still living when he returned in 63?
No, his father had long since died.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the great regrets of his life was that after he had this knockdown, drag-out fight, announcing he was going to the Jesuits, he had never returned home again. And he had never reconciled with his father. And he carried that heavy burden the rest of his life, always regretting it. But if we believe that, as he did, everything happened in his life for a reason,
yeah.
Maybe that happened for
now,
a reason.
Do you know if his father has had his priestly ordination?
No, he was ordained in Rome, and his family was very poor.
Yeah, sure.
And there were just a few people in Rome were present at the ordination.
You know, when you told us, I mean, it's a wonderful story. When you told us about what a fighter he was and how unpleasant in his youth, I was reminded of the saying, I'm sure we've all heard, I like to use it in preaching, every saint has a past, every sinner has a future.
That's very good. Saint
and also your story about the rushing, going to open the door when the other lazy Jesus wouldn't. reminded me of my own. A public confession is good for the soul, so I would confess you. I live on the second floor of the rectory, over the, it's not the front door, it's the back door that everyone uses, you see, it's the kitchen door. And when there's no one else in the house, somebody's ringing the bell, I throw open the open the window and shout, can I help you? So maybe, you know, I give myself the excuse, I'll be 86 years old in a few weeks. So I thought, I can't rob him downstairs.
Good for you. At least you're answering the door, Father. Father would be proud. Walter would be proud of me. One of my seminary classmates from, I attended Overbrook in Philadelphia for 4 years. And one of my classmates had been going up to Fordham for spiritual direction. He 1 year called me to say, you know, I'm so happy that you're the postulator for Father Chizik because I go to Father Chizik for spiritual direction. I said, oh, that's really great. Like, how did you happen on Father Chizik as your spiritual director? He said, I'd been going up to another Jesuit at Fordham for spiritual direction. And he said, I went up one day, as I usually did every couple of months, rang the doorbell, and he said, this nice little old man with a little sweater on, like my mother used to wear when she hung the clothes out, that was Walter, nice little old man answered the door, and I said, is Father so-and-so here? He said, no, he's not here today. He says, well, I came for spiritual direction. Walter says, well, I'm sorry, he's not here. He says, that means that God didn't want you to see him today. But I am here, and that means maybe God wanted you to see me. And that's how literally he did believe that you must do God's will. And Father Chizik became a spiritual director, and he said it was, you know, one of the greatest actual graces in his life. And one of his sisters who testified in the process, kind of throwing some light on this literal, naive, childlike belief in doing God's will. His sister was a nun in a community, the Bernardine Sisters, a Polish community of nuns that had a mother house in our Diocese of Allentown. And the sister, after he had returned home, you might imagine, a nun would call her brother priest and say, Father Walter, we're having our big annual picnic this year, and it's a big event, and we depend upon it so much. Well, Walter, you know, we have to raise some money, she said, and please pray that it won't rain. And he said, oh, sister, I can't pray that it won't rain. Suppose God wants it to rain. So our former bishop, well, she had really seized on that and thought, boy, isn't there a story in that, that we so often say to God, we don't want it to rain, but suppose God wants it to rain. And God wants it to rain, perhaps for some very good reason, which was really epitomizes the whole story of a father's life.
Are there any miracles?
We have a whole bunch of them, but we're at that point, we're not yet at the point where we have to prove the miracles. The cause, I should have told you, is at the end of the very first phase. The first phase and the cause is called the diocesan phase. Father Dave knows all about that. In the diocesan phase, you're expected to gather all of the documents that would serve to prove the candidate, the servant of God, his holiness was heroic, above and beyond. And we have assembled all the documents, sent the documents to Rome. They graciously, after giving us a great deal of difficulty, the way they usually do in Rome, they graciously said, they're valid. That's a great Roman expression. Constat de validitate. It was a great prize we won when we got that. So now the Jesuit postulator in Rome must use the information in the documents to prove that the virtue was heroic. When the congregation agrees that the virtue was heroic, then they would recommend the Holy Father declare him venerable. And we're at that point of waiting for the declaration of heroic virtue. And after that, then, please God, we will be able to prove that one of the miracles, they're alleged miracles, we have several folders of them. These alleged miracles were indeed truly miracles. But that's, again, another very exhaustive process of assembling all kinds of medical records and getting competent expert testimony. But we're not at that stage yet. Yes, sir.
Given that the primary virtue for Jesuit is corpse-like obedience, and everything I know about Walter Chizik shows him as being a very willful, he didn't take no for an answer, as you said. Is that going to be an obstacle to eventually his canonization?
Well, all of that was transformed, however. Mm-hmm. You know, in the course of his life, through his suffering, he did. You know, when he did give himself totally to the doing of God's will for him. And when he came home, his superiors were very gentle with him. And there was at least a semblance of disobedience. He really did not want to write that first book. In the old days, Walter would have said, no, that's it. But he did. With God in Russia was a book he did not want to write because he felt they wanted to write it in such a way that it was too much about him.
But you can even read in that book, it's a lower quality than his book on
That's the core of his spiritualities. Yeah. And so he much of it makes its way into the first book, but not at the same level, at the same depth of spirituality that you find in the second book. And he gave himself heart and soul for the writing of the second book. Yes.
His story is very compelling. The sad thing is today, when such a child was brought before a magistrate or some other official, the child would have been drugged.
And that impulse, which he
was probably be diagnosed with ADHD, and probably have been drugged.
Probably, that they would have done their very best to make him manageable. But the difference, he was the son of really devout parents. They were really good Christians. They were exasperated by this kid because he just, well, he was not obedient. He was ornery. And he describes it himself. I mean, he was a really tough kid. And, you know, when you read the testimony, in fact, much of what he wrote about his life, the autobiographical details, didn't make its way into that first book. And he was very disappointed because he felt that a real understanding of himself required that you knew what kind of a rotten kid he was. he really wanted that to be included. And he was assisted in the writing of the book by a wonderful Jesuit priest who was one of the editors at America Magazine. It was a very difficult task. The way that the book was written, the priest who was on the board at America in New York flew down to Reading, where Walter was at Wernersville. And in the course of the week, Walter was to write a chapter or so of the book. And then Walter and Dan, the Jesuit priest, and Dan had a wonderful facility for writing clear, simple, declarative sentences, and you find it in the book. Dan would say, okay, Walter, and Dan is a great big tall guy. Walter was a grunt of a guy, a very little guy. And Dan would say, you know, after several years of working with Walter on the book, he developed a lean to the left, trying to get down to Walter. But as they'd walk around the grounds at Wernersville, Walter would start to relate what he had written that week, and Dan would say, by about the fourth word, Walter was at the 10th level of abstraction, way, way up there. You know, he did not have a facility for expressing himself simply. And it was almost as if this was just almost too much for him to try to put into words. But fortunately, Dan, who says every word in the book is Walter's, but Dan had the very difficult task, but very essential task, of rendering it in a way that it was intelligible, that you really understood what he was trying to say, because he struggled so hard to say what he wanted to say. I find that still very often, as we're at that point in the process where we're still going back and bringing some stuff out that they can use at this point to prove his heroic virtue. And I am very often at odds with the postulator in Rome, the Jesuit, because he's a Dutchman, and his command of English is very good, but it's a little funny. So, and he's aware of that. In spite of the Jesuit, he's not too proud. Being a Jesuit, he's not too proud. And he always sends me whatever he writes, as he says, to English it. And so, you know, when he writes, summarizes something that Walter said. Walter, he had a mystical experience that was, I mean, how do you put it into words? You know, he had suffered a very serious heart attack, and he was unconscious for at least 2 hours, and they thought he was dead. And then when he came back from it, much to everybody's surprise, although he didn't begin to talk about it soon, quickly after the experience, little by little, he began to talk about, during that time, having seen our Lord. And it was an experience, and it couldn't have been totally visual, so this is why it was so hard for him to explain it. It was an experience, certainly, of Jesus, where he could see him visually, but he experienced the presence of the Holy Spirit, the presence of God the Father. It was the presence of the Holy Trinity. He was, how he struggled to put into words the experience. And it's almost incomprehensible when you read it. He did try to write it. So the Father Mark, the Jesuit in Rome, kind of very gently edited it and sent it to me. And I felt, well, you know, this is basically like what Father Dan had to do. You had to bring it from the abstract down to the concrete. It's not a message, really, a task of editing. It's a task almost of translation. I had read so much of what Walter wrote that I developed a sense. He uses words sometimes strangely, not the way everybody would use them. So you don't understand what he's saying, but I know what he means by that word. And I would put in what I know Walter meant. And Mark would write back and say, don't rewrite it. You know, it's not you, it's Walter. And I'd have to write back to Rome saying, well, if you want people to understand what he's saying, this is what he's saying. So we've had these arguments back and forth. Once in a while he wins, once in a while I win, but hopefully it will all come out that people will understand something of the deep holiness of this man. That's what really matters.
Was that after 63 in the United States, or was it in Russia that he had the heart?
No, he had it back here, close to the end of his life.
Oh.
Yes.
In his retreat work over the last 21 years, did he preach retreats to seminarians, priests, novices at all, do you know? Because I'm wondering if he had a particular take on his fiat or his sushipe with regard to sort of typical priestly life and challenges.
He did preach to the novices at Wernersville. He did preach. He preached in many, many cases, it seems, in sheer volume, I'd say, the greatest percentage of the conferences was to women religious. And he really felt that they had a tremendous potential for good, and certainly they certainly achieved a great deal in his own life, the influence that they had upon him, which really led to his vocation, and that they had a greater potential for good than they realized. I think that's one of the saddest things that we experience in our day, is that I don't think the women religious realized the tremendous influence for good that they were and made such radical changes. That's another story. But he did, I would say, in terms of volume, the greatest volume was women religious, although he did preach to seminarians. And I don't think there were any large groups of priests. A lot of his spiritual direction focused on lay people. But it wouldn't be that he sought anybody out. But his ministry was always a response to people who came to him. And always with the conviction that that was not accident. God had sent that person. And he would give that person all of his time and attention, really seeing it as a serious obligation they had from God himself.
Did he have any specific takes on the celebration of the Mass because of the liturgy of his life?
He had difficulties because when he came back home in 63, the Vatican Council had just begun. He, of course, had been celebrating Mass in the Byzantine liturgy. When he was back at Fordham, the environment, although it was the John 23rd Center on the Eastern Rite liturgy, where they did celebrate the Eastern liturgy, he gravitated very heavily toward the Latin liturgy, which is one of the reasons why I think the Ruthenians were not too interested in pursuing the cause. He struggled with all of the changes that were occurring in the liturgy. He was very obedient. He always did it, but he wrote about how hard it was for him to adapt to all that was happening. And he was tremendously troubled by, in that period, I think things have settled down, but you're too young maybe to remember. But the 60s was a very difficult time in the church, where every priest who had a crazy idea thought he could write his own Eucharistic prayer, and all kinds of crazy things were happening. He was deeply troubled by those kinds of liberties with the liturgy, particularly in his own community, and many of the Jesuits who, you know, had that fourth vow of obedience to the Holy Father were not regarding it at all. It troubled him very deeply. But the Mass was tremendously important to him. And for him, as he celebrated Mass after his return, there was always the wonderful remembrance of Mass in those prison camps, you know, with that little crust of bread, and how people, not only he would fast all day, but in those days, those people, you know, observed the fast that they had been brought up to observe. People in those dreadful conditions would fast all day from that tiny little bit of food that they would have had in order to be able to receive the Eucharist after work was done. It was central in his life, the Eucharist. The traditional things, he had a deep, deep love for Mary, for the Blessed Mother. And in that mystical experience, he does talk about somehow Mary being present in that mystical experience. That's it.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for your very, very kind attention. It's such a pleasure to be with you. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. And I would encourage you, I didn't bring anything along, but the books, if you haven't read them, they're really worth reading. If you've read them, they're worth reading again.
Yes.
And there is a real spirituality there that I think really came through Walter from God himself. It's worth taking it seriously. God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you, Roger.